Good evening, everyone. Glad to have you out this evening. We're going to be continuing our trek through the book of Hebrews. We have this Sunday and next Sunday, so we've only got two Sundays to finish up here. And I have a little over two chapters left to do, so we're getting close. And we'll accomplish it next Sunday, no matter what. We're in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We got down into the 11th chapter last week. We're just going to look at a couple of things in there before we move on quickly to chapter 12. But I think it's important that we get the summary and get things kind of tied together for this great chapter. But it is pretty familiar with most everybody, so we'll continue to move through that pretty rapidly. Before we start this evening, Ken, would you lead us in a word of prayer, please? Thank you. Amen. As we look at Hebrews 11, I think it's very obvious that there is a single theme that runs through this particular chapter, and that theme is what?
Faith.
And we got through the early part last week, and I think we got down to right around where Moses and the people were leaving Egypt, about the verse 28 or so, and we talked about Moses leaving Pharaoh's household. If he wanted to really stay with something that was a really good job security, staying there in Egypt would have been a better plan. Some of the slides I showed last week, that was a pretty rich society there in terms of the people who were in the upper class, which Moses would have been part of. But it says, by faith, he was looking to the reward in verse 26, looking past that. And it also mentions him looking forward to Christ, which is something that we don't always think about because that's not specifically mentioned in the Old Testament stories. But the faith continues building, and I find it interesting, right after the Passover in verse 28, in verse 29 it says, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. And by faith the walls of Jericho fell down, after they'd been encircled for 7 days. So he mentions two events that are not Moses' faith, but who's the prime people here involved that he's using as an example of faith? The Israelites, right? But there's really something interesting about these two events. They bracket the 40 years, don't they? And so was it the same group of Israelites? No. So one of the things that he's sort of subtly injecting into the storyline here is that this one group that had the faith to go out of Egypt with Moses and cross the Red Sea lost their faith. Okay? But it was their children who picked it up again and were able to march on and conquer the city of Jericho. So this whole chapter is moving towards this a conclusion he's going to come to where faith isn't something that you just have and then you've got it and then it always is. Faith is something you have to keep working on. We talked about that in our lesson this morning, to keep it active and keep it strong. So he brackets those two. And then in verse 31, by faith Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Now, we're going to talk about a few of the other examples here of faith, but every once in a while, aren't there characters and stories thrown in that are used that are a little unusual? And when you think of Rahab, that's a little unusual in the story there, right? She exhibited faith, but at the time that she did that, she lied, for starters, and she wasn't even an Israelite. Okay? Is it possible for people to see God's grace, to see God's workings, and to come to a conclusion that they need to be part of whatever kingdom God has put together? Rahab was one of those folks. Anybody remember when the spies came in and she agreed to hide them, what she told them? Why did she agree to do that? What did she say? We remember, we've heard about you. But how long ago? They had heard about them in Egypt and all of the great wonders that come out of there. That was 40 years prior. And the stories were still being told about what had gone on in Egypt. And she understood what was fixing to happen to the land of Canaan there. And so she made preparations. There are some other stories. I'm going to get into some of them, but I was reminded this afternoon as I was looking through. I said, you know, sometimes we use illustrations and touch points and a reminder in history, and that's what these are. They're touch points. They're things that they should have known or remembered in their history and that they would be able to draw example from and be able to pattern their lives. And some of the examples are great. We understand them. Others we have to work out a little bit. And some of the people there. And it reminded me of, you know, in Texas, there's one story that trumps all others. What is it? The Alamo, right? And you remember the Alamo. And I've always thought that was a very interesting story because they lost. You know, it's, but there were ramifications to it and all that kind of thing, which makes it, you know, the story. But, sometimes stories don't quite always fit the theme, I think, anyway. But here, there's no deviating from it. So when we look on at these other examples, the author says, "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets." He's making a really nice concession to time here. You know, this is one of those things where somebody has a lot of things in mind and they're preaching a long sermon and they look at their watch and realize they're running out of time, which he's only got, you know, two chapters to close out his letter here. He's saying, there's a lot more I could say on this subject. I mean, if I wanted to talk about all of these people, and he makes a list, and this is where it gets really interesting. This list isn't in chronological order. They're kind of mixed up here a little bit. And it also includes some people that we don't often think of, like Barak. What was he? Anybody remember even? He was a general. He was a commander. Who was the judge under which he was the commander? And my wife always knows this one, right? It's Deborah. And he was told to go out into battle, and he said, sure, why not? As long as you come with me. You know, he wanted Deborah along with him. And so he was a little reluctant at first and had to go through some things just like some of these others. Gideon, we talked a lot about him on a recent sermon that Marshall gave. Reluctant hero, right? Timid at first and then grew into this role and finally was able to, you know, achieve great things for God. But to me, the most enigmatic one on the list, who is it for you? Who's the one on there, Ken, that you think of that you go, this seems strange in this list? Anybody? Okay, Jephthah's an interesting one. That's a little on the strange side. But to me, it's Samson. If we had to pick somebody who had troubles in his life. And what were the kinds of difficulties that Samson had in his life? He had trouble with women, right? As Benjamin pointed out this morning, he had trouble with anger management. He had trouble keeping his mouth shut when he was told not to say anything. How many issues you want to go through with this man? He was arrogant. He was brash. And yet he's listed here in the Hall of Faith. And we wonder how somebody who could have that many flaws could be listed in this august company. And yet when you look at his life, even there at the very end, what was the last thing that Samson did? What was the last thing he did? Yeah, he killed more Philistines in dying. He prayed one more time to God to give him the strength to pull that house down. And he destroyed the Philistine leadership. Now, it's interesting when you think about it, because his counterpart is mentioned in this list as well. What role? Samson, when he was born, he was consigned to a special group of people. What were they? The Nazarites, okay? What was it about a Nazarite? What were their restrictions? Okay? Can't cut their hair. Can't take in. Eat anything made out of any grape product, leaves, grapes, and the whole works, okay? And they were set aside for service. There was another Nazarite, started to say Samsonite, but that's luggage. There was another Nazarite that was contemporary with Samson. Who was that? Give you a hint, he's in the list as well. Samson. And Samuel. Two S's there. What was Samuel? He was set aside as a Nazarite as well. Now, can you imagine two more unlike people? But they had different roles to play in their faith. There wasn't, you notice, during Samson's time, there wasn't an Israelite army. Why was that? Who was in charge? That's the answer to everything, right? God was always in charge. Okay, God's still in charge, but who was it that ruled the Israelites? We'll rephrase the question there. It was the Philistines. And if you remember, the Israelites couldn't even sharpen their own plows. They had to go get their tools sharpened by the Philistines. That was economic control. They didn't want them having any of this ability to beat plowshares into swords, right? So what did they do for an army when it was time to go after the Philistines? They didn't need an army. They had Samson. He was the one-man army, right? Get a bunch of Philistines together. What did Samson do? Picks up the jawbone of a donkey and kills 600 of them. But his counterpart, Samuel, was responsible for getting the spiritual life back together in Israel. And so the two of them kind of made an interesting balance there during that time period. Stories of faith, people who were operating under extremely adverse conditions and yet were able to accomplish great things for God. So what all did they do? By faith they conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions. Who would that be? Got to at least get Daniel in there, right? Quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. So all this list of things, and this isn't a connect-the-dot list. This isn't find the names in verse 1 and connect them to their deed in verse 2. He mentions a bunch of names, he mentions a bunch of deeds. One of the interesting things about this list of deeds is that not all of them are recorded in the Old Testament. Some of the things, like some of the prophets that were sawn in two or people being tortured, those are written in a lot of the intertestamental period Jewish literature. Things like the Maccabees record several incidents there that are, you know, historically accurate in terms of the things that the people were suffering. And just because that part wasn't canonical, it's not part of the Old Testament that we accept as being inspired by God, it doesn't mean that those events didn't happen. There was a lot of faith during that period, a lot of things that went on with those people and the struggles that they had. I heard some people once, slight side note, during the time of the Maccabees is when, anybody know what Hanukkah is a Jewish holiday? Anybody ever heard of Hanukkah? Okay, you haven't lived in South Florida, so yeah, okay, Hanukkah. Now all my kids know what Hanukkah is. Okay, what is Hanukkah? It's the festival of lights. But what does it celebrate? Yeah, it was a rededication of the temple after it had been defiled by Antiochus Epiphanes and his group. And the reason it was it is a prominent Jewish celebration is because they believed that there was a miracle that took place then. They only had enough oil to light the lamps for one night, and they stayed lit for seven. Is it possible that there was a miracle that occurred then? Could be. Now, we don't have a divine record of it, but that doesn't mean that they were totally in a period where God wasn't looking out for them. So it's possible. We don't know for sure, but it's possible. We have a lot of other records at that time of the things that people did because of their faith. So the writer here is drawing from all of history, all of their history. And there's a couple things we need to note about it. Did justification by faith begin with Abraham? When did it start? Who was the first one he mentioned in Hebrews? Abel, right? Started there. You can't get much further back than that. And he brings it up all the way through the intertestamental period, right up to their modern time. So what conclusion can you draw from all of these examples of what God wants from people? I think the obvious conclusion is he always has wanted people to have faith. Then, through history, now, it's the same. And the faith must be active for it to be acceptable. These women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release, in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourging. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. All these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Now I want to notice a couple things about, we talked a little bit about all these things that they went through and whatnot. When he talks about they were in sheepskins and goatskins, do you understand what the importance of that is? What is it about them being in sheepskins and goatskins? What does that mean? They didn't have nice clothes. Sheepskins and goatskins were just animal skins that they could get. I mean, if they could slaughter a sheep or a goat, you got a goat skin, you can treat it well enough to wear it. It was a sign of poverty. It was a sign they didn't have much. Now, it says that they wandered around and they were in caves and holes in the ground and, you know, lived a life out in areas where it's very tough. And you think about it and you think, okay, especially during the Middle Ages, but even today sometimes, folks decide that they want to be like a hermit, you know? That if I want to be really close to God, then I can go put on sheepskin and I can go find myself a cave up in a mountain somewhere, and if I live there, and people will come to me because I've decided to be a really holy guy. And several trips that we've taken, there's these spots that you'll see, you know, like there across from the lake, see that cave, you know, there, that was Saint so-and-so who set up shop in this cave, you know. What's the difference between those folks and the ones that are being written here?
I think of Elijah, who was running for his life, living in the cave.
Yeah. Those people lived in caves because they had to. It's not because that's where they were trying to live to say, oh, well, if I, you know, afflict myself with all of these things, then people will think I'm a really holy person. That wasn't the point. The point was, is they were being persecuted. They were being chased. Their lives were in danger. And the only thing left to them was to flee or give up their faith. And given that choice, they kept their faith. That's the whole point of all of these folks, of all of the hardships that they went through. If you look at each one of them, could they have made different decisions? Could they have said, you know, and Gideon is beating out the wheat, and God says, Gideon, I want you to, you know, to be the commander of the army. Gideon, it was within his power to say, I don't think so. Now about Elijah, Benjamin mentioned, what kind of trouble did he get in for all of the things that he did with the kings and with, you know, good old what's-her-name, Jezebel, saying, you know, if I don't make you like one of the prophets of Baal tomorrow, then, you know. Of course, they were all dead. That was the whole point. She was threatening him. They had choices, and the choices they made were to choose on the side of faith. These people are being reminded of that. And if you look at those last couple of verses, it's kind of interesting, because I think you need to kind of pull it all together. They didn't receive what was promised. Now, did they receive part of what was promised? Were they able to have a relationship with their God? Absolutely. But they didn't receive that end view, did they? Did they know it was coming? I think they did. Now, I don't think they knew exactly what was coming. It's interesting when Peter talks about it, and he talks about, you know, these things that even which angels long to look. And the prophets of old were speaking, knowing they were talking to us, really wishing they could understand what all they were saying. And so there was some mystery there. There was some things that people didn't quite understand. But they kept their eye on the future. There's an interesting difference in the Jewish race and in most other civilizations and groups of people that populate this earth. How many times have you sat around with a group of old folks like me or whatever, or older or whatever, and somebody will start reminiscing about the good old days? Right? There's always some point in the past that we can point to when things were better. You know, inflation wasn't as bad, and people had more respect, and, you know, whatever you want to put there. There was this point in the past that was the best, and it's just gone downhill from there on out. Isn't that kind of the way a lot of people have an outlook on life? The Jews never had that outlook. They kind of occasionally would look back at the glory days of Solomon. That was about the best they could do. But in their view, the best was always yet to come. They were always looking for a future. The faithful ones were. And so when they ran into trouble, it was like, well, oy vey, here we go again. It's trouble. We'll get through this because there's hope for the future. There's something in the future. And all of their literature is like that. There's always this world to come that they're looking for. And that's what he's talking about here. There's a lot of proverbs in the Bible that talk about this. You know, where a man's treasure is, that's where his heart is, right? Well, if you put your treasure here in this time and this place, that's where your heart is. Well, that's not where these folks had their treasure. Theirs was out in the future. Theirs was looking beyond the sufferings that they were entangled in then. But they died without receiving this promise, but God says had provided or foreseen. There's another, if you've got a marginal rendition there, God had foreseen something better for us. He'd foreseen this better thing. Isn't that what the theme of Hebrews has been all about? Is this better nature that was coming, the better sacrifice, the better high priest, the better promises that God has given us. And when you get there, could these folks partake in that final joy after a while? You see, it's not two tracks. It's not them and us. The place that they were looking for and they're heading for, they said they wanted that city with foundations. Were they just looking to the coming of Christ? What were they looking for? They were looking for that ultimate salvation, weren't they? And that ultimate home. It's the same thing we're looking for. And so we're not going to get there before they do, and they're not going to get there before we do. It's not apart from us. We're in this together. I think that's part of what he's trying to say with these folks on faith. He's used a bunch of examples of Old Testament, of the very history that he said Christ is better than what they had, and yet they were great examples of faith. And the whole point is, we're in this together. And we can use their examples to help strengthen us and move forward and to help hold our faith. We're going to be in this together. And the ultimate view is what they all have in mind. And that's what he said there when he looked at, back in verse 13, they died without receiving the promises. But if you look at what they wanted, they desired a better country. That is a heavenly one. They wanted that final place. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every cumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and sat down on the right hand of God. What's the great cloud of witnesses? That one's pretty obvious, right? All the stuff in the previous chapter. What's the sin which so easily besets us? Losing our faith, faithlessness. That's the sin that he really wants these people to avoid. And you know what? Aren't there just a lot of other sins that are simply fallout from this one? That once you lose your faith, then, or your faith weakens, then that's what opens the doors to a lot of other things. And if you want to get back on track, the first thing you got to do is get that faith back in order and get yourself firmly planted on God's side. And then it takes care of a lot of other problems. The faith is the faithlessness, is the sin that so easily entangles us. Entangling, I was reminding you, most of you have seen the kids with the spider web. You know, up there, they like that orb web spider. You get this picture of sin entangling people. Well, that's a really good example of it. They threw a grasshopper in there this morning. And what did that spider do with the grasshopper? It entangled it. It just wrapped that thing up to where that grasshopper couldn't move. And isn't that the way sin is sometimes? That if we get too deep into it, the deeper you get, it just gets its hold tighter and tighter on you. It just wraps you up so that it just looks like you can't get out. And that's what we got to realize. There's always this way out. And that's what we have to be looking for. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart, using Christ as the example there. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? That's one of the hard things that we kind of have to realize about some of the trials, problems, tribulations that we go through in life. Learning is painful. I was using an example of Joshua's learning to walk now. What happens when babies start learning to walk? What do? A lot. They fall down, right? You think they enjoy that? Now, I've often commented, it's a good thing that they're that short and they've got very lots of padded diapers on and things like that, because if we did the kind of falls that they do, we'd be just a mess. So they're kind of built for it. But they still fall. Now, there's two paths that you can take there when you have something like that and you go through a trial and you fail. What are the two things you can do? You can quit, or you can get back up and try it again. If you quit, are you ever going to learn? I mean, I remember keenly starting to learn to ride a bike. Because the reason I remember it keenly was there was this incident with downhill on a bike and some rose bushes. There was a point where I was sure that those two wheels would be hung up forever and would never, ever see my seat on that seat again. But you know what? After a while, it's second nature, and you learn how to do it, right? It doesn't mean you still don't have wrecks. I still did, but that's beside the point. And you still learn something from each of those. But you know, in our lives, we go through painful things. We all do. Or we see people who go through painful things. And one way of looking at that is, you know, how a lot of people look at it, right? Why, Lord? Why me? You know, why have you put all of this stuff on me? What does this passage say? It's not why me, God's punishing us. It's God is disciplining us. Now, discipline quite often doesn't mean punishment in this sense. Discipline is enforcing. Discipline is getting things set in order. Discipline is putting things in place that need to be there. We discipline our children when we make rules for them and then make sure that they abide by the rules. A lot of us in here are parents that have gone through this or are going through it. Is that the most fun thing that you do, is make up rules for your kids and then enforce it? Is that really what you get enjoyment out of life doing? So why do we do it? Yeah, because we don't want hooligans running around, right? We realize that without discipline, without some pain in their lives, and I'm not talking about necessarily spanking or whatever, but by something that says their will has to be abrogated to our will in some way, that's painful for them, but without that, they will not learn properly, and they will not understand how to live among us. And these people here had undergone some great trials, but he says they had not yet suffered to the point of death. So nobody had died yet because of their trials, and yet these trials, part of it they'd gone through, and I think the picture that kind of evolves here in Hebrews is a group of folks that, you know, they were faithful, and they had come out and they had learned and they had gone through some trials and they had survived things. And then time was kind of marching on and maybe things eased up a little bit, but then it looked like they were getting worse or the trials are still there. And after a while, they started asking themselves, are we really on the right track? Are we going to be able to hang in here? Maybe it'd be easier if we just quit this stuff called Christianity. That's the endurance part. The faith gets you started. But if you want to keep your faith, the second piece you have to add to it that's just important is endurance. The ability to hang in there. You ever known people that just conquered all kinds of odds to accomplish a goal that they'd set for themselves? And we look at them in awe sometimes and think, wow, how could they do that? Well, how did they do it? They fixed their eye on the goal, and they wouldn't let anything get them off path. And that is precisely what he's telling the Hebrews here to do. He says these folks we listed in chapter 11, they had their eye on a goal, right? And look at what they suffered to get there. Now, you guys haven't even suffered to death yet. And, you know, in our day and age, that's easy for us to say, isn't it? We don't have anywhere near the same kinds of sufferings and things that they did. But does that mean that we don't have to take the same kind of action? Does that mean that we don't have to watch our lives and make sure that we are still aligned with God and that we've got our eye on the goal? And that the very fact that we don't have something sort of pricking us in the side all of the time, it's easy to develop a thing called complacency, right? We talked about the lesson this morning, being a slug. So there's always things that we have to deal with in our lives. That's part of what being human and being on this planet is all about. And that's what he's trying to get these folks to understand, is that no matter what the temptation that comes along, there's only one real way to deal with it, and that is to keep your eye on the goal and to keep your faith. It is for discipline that you endure, and God deals with you as sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Therefore strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Now I want to look closely at those last couple of verses there for a minute. We talked about the discipline part. And the one really good thing about it is if it's God's discipline, unlike parents, who we do our best, right? Have you ever made mistakes in disciplining your children? I think all of us would have to admit to that at one time or another. And you just hope that you do your best and you make as few mistakes as possible. There's one really good thing about God's discipline. What is that? He doesn't make mistakes. He knows exactly what we need, and he's not going to give us something that we can't take. We've got that promise from him. It's kind of like being beat into shape, right? Okay. We're not necessarily going to enjoy the path, but if we'll put our mind to it and we'll understand that it's what God is using to strengthen us, then when we come out of the other end, we will be better. So we have that discipline. But along the way, these last couple of verses there make us say something interesting. They say, lift up the feeble. When we went back in chapter 10 and we had those three let us them, what was that third one? Let us not forsake the assembling of ourselves together as men of some men, but do what? Encourage one another. There's the lifting up. Now, the thing that he says there is, so that the lame will get healed. What does he mean by that? Well, here's the picture he's trying to paint. If someone has a bum knee, my wife went through knee surgery, right? The doctor didn't look at it and go, well, you got a bad knee. I think what we need to do is give you some really heavy work and heavy lifting to do and really just put all your weight on that knee all the time. Why is that not a good idea? It's not going to get better, right? What do you do besides surgery? Okay, you have a crutch, or you have somebody else who will help you, or something to take the weight off of that knee until it heals. Are there times when people need help because they're down and they need time to heal? Absolutely. So what's the group supposed to do with that person? Stomp them while they're down? The group is supposed to help lift them up. And that's what he's saying here, these folks. Look, you've got a group there. You guys need to be helping each other work this out. That's why they needed to come together. That's why they needed to spend some time together. That's why they needed to be a functioning group, was so that they could help each other when these kinds of things came up. My wife and I found out over the years, it's really hard to be mad at somebody who spent a lot of time at your dinner table. Right? Why? Because you've shared something. Because people have had this conversation over sharing food. And there's nothing as disarming as sitting down with a good meal, right? It's just hard to get a lot of conflict under those kind of conditions. Sometimes I think we need to figure out ways that people can just get to know each other better and be better. I mean, some of the social group things and things that we're doing, you might look at it and go, why do we want to do that? You know, it's really kind of an imposition, a schedule and all that kind of thing. And whoever's got slated to set it up, I mean, that's some extra work, right? Trying to figure out what am I going to do in my house and who's going to cook and all these kind of things. So why do we bother with it? I hope everybody here has gone to some of the meetings. Has somebody gone to some social group? Did you get a chance to talk to anybody that you really hadn't talked to before much? Learn a little bit more about them? Find some interesting things about that you didn't know before about Christians that you meet with every week, right? And goodness knows, we talk a lot at this building. I mean, that's one of the good things about it, is it's hard to get services started sometimes because everybody's chatting at each other. That's a good thing. But if it's just here, and it's just for 5 minutes, we're not going to learn the kind of things about each other that we need to know to do what he's talking about here in Hebrews 12, which is to be able to lift each other up. So, folks, that's an important part of what he's talking about, is not only that we have to keep our faith, but we have to help others, therefore strengthen the hands that are feeble, your own and other people. Get the strength. Use it. Make straight the paths for your feet so that whatever's lame can be healed. Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble and by it many be defiled, that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought for it with tears. Be at peace with all men. I don't know about you, but that's quite often a very difficult thing for me to do. There's some folks that it's hard to be at peace with. They just rankle you the wrong way. That's just the way it is. But we have to try. That's what it says. We have to try. Our job is to try to be peaceful. Now, does that mean that there's never going to be a conflict? No. Does that mean that we have to just be pushovers all the time and just let people run all over us? In Romans, it says, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. We do our part. It's not always going to work. But we do our part. And if we do our part, that's all God's expecting of us. So these people that are under persecution, under trial, this would be tough for them. They're to try to be at peace with even the people that are persecuting them. Doesn't that seem kind of strange? Doesn't that seem hard? Or maybe even harsh? But he said, that's the only way this is going to work. It's up to you. You try to be at peace with all men. And don't come short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. Root of bitterness. That's a really good, another one of those agricultural examples there, right? We had this orange tree in our backyard in Florida. And we moved into the house, and it was a pretty big tree, had lots of oranges on it at the time. And we're thinking, this is really going to be good. I mean, I love citrus, right? You got your own orange tree. And so we gleefully, when they got ripe, you know, picked a couple of them, peeled them all off. They were terrible. They were sour. They were bitter. They wouldn't even have made good lemonade. Now, it turns out what had happened is that one of the hardiest varieties of orange is this thing that they call bitter root stock. Okay, it's a sour orange stock. And then what they do is they graft good limbs onto it so that their stock and the roots are really hardy, but the things that produce the fruit have really good fruit on them. It's a nice relationship. Somewhere along the line, this tree had lost all the good branches, right? And all that was left was the bitter root stock. So what do you think I did with it? I cut it down, absolutely. I wasn't going to, if you can't eat those things, I didn't want them all over my yard to have to hit with a lawnmower, right? So that tree left. Real disappointment. This root of bitterness, it can ruin things, right? When bitterness springs up between folks, that's hard sometimes to patch, isn't it? Who's the example that he gives here for this root of bitterness, the Old Testament example? Esau. What was the bitterness there? Where'd that come from? Jealousy. Yeah. There was a really jealous relationship. When you go back, they didn't exactly have the best family practices there in terms of the way they treated their kids unequally and that kind of thing. Dad liked one, mom liked the other, and they kept flouting it to each other. And Esau was only older by, a couple of minutes as the twin that got a handout first or whatever. And so all their lives, instead of growing up close to each other, these two brothers are very different and grew up. And then there was that whole deal with the birthright thing, right? Now, there's an interesting thing about that. It says that that was the root of bitterness between them. And that Esau wanted to change that, even though he sought it with tears, he wasn't able to. Does that mean that Esau repented of his actions and all of those kinds of things? What's it really saying when it's talking about him here? What's that? Changed his mind. Yeah, he wanted it better. It was too late. Yeah, so that bitterness caused a separation of that family for a lot of years. And when his brother Jacob was coming back from having lived with Laban and all those kinds of things and getting all of his wealth kind of started on his own, kind of bootstrapping himself back together there, what was one of the things that he feared about coming back down into that area? Meeting Esau, right? Will he remember that I stole the birthright? They finally gotten over it, but exactly. It's just hard to get rid of. It really could be. And I think those are exactly the kinds of things that we have to watch out for as Christians. And our lives, to make sure that those bitter things like Esau don't turn us into bitter people. And that when you see something like that coming up later in your life that you might have even thought you'd buried or taken care of, and it hits you again, fix it, right? So that's what he's saying here. You got to have faith in God. Yeah. Well, we got this wisteria that I cut down finally because it wouldn't bloom, and it's in this area in the back of the yard, the little corner flower bed. And I noticed today as I was walking, taking out the garbage, there's another wisteria branch sticking up. I mean, like that's the fourth or fifth time that I've dug down in there and dug roots out, and it's still coming back. I will conquer it, though. Any other questions? That's all we have time for tonight. Thank you.